lapse of time. Today, the weekly picture magazine Life is the only magazine to have a newsstand sale of more than 1 million copies a week in the United States. And still, the demand for Life is far from filled. Not only are most newsstands selling out on Friday, the day of publication, but recent tests in Detroit and other cities have shown that if Life presses could supply the copies, the U.S. newsstand sale would be not 1 million, but over 3 million copies each week. For this unprecedented demand, there is one outstanding reason. Life is the only news picture magazine on the newsstand. Every week, thousands of news pictures are rushed to Life from all the news fronts of the world. The editors select those which can best tell the news stories of the week. Life is printed on its coated paper at newspaper speed, shipped by the fastest trains, and is on the newsstands every Friday with the stories and pictures of the week's events. 1 million copies of the new issue of Life will be on sale at newsstands tomorrow, but many news dealers will be sold out by tomorrow night. So to make sure of getting your copy, we suggest you ask your news dealer for it tomorrow, Friday morning.
Tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, joins Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time.
Ah, my friends and constituents, beware of the Pope of Rome. Why did the price of cotton go down? Because the Pope of Rome wouldn't wear a cotton nightshirt. And when the Pope of Rome don't wear a cotton nightshirt, there's 10 million Catholics in America that won't buy cotton nightshirts. My friend, the Pope of Rome.
Thus, for nearly 3 decades, through the halls of the U.S. Congress, boomed the voice of Alabama's Tom Heflin, whose hatred and fear of the Roman Pope was his sole issue, his sole obsession, his vote-getter, and his insignia of office. Through the Teddy Roosevelt era, the World War, the Harding Coolidge Hoover prosperity era, Tom Heflin became a Washington landmark. Then in 1931, the old-time senatorial coattails, high collar, and elk's tooth watch chain of Tom Heflin were seen no more in Washington. The issue of the Roman Pope was dead. Tom was defeated, forced to bide his time for 6 years. Then, 8 weeks ago,
my fellow countrymen, after 6 years, I am proud to stand before you again as a candidate for that lofty office.
Running for the Senate seat vacated by Alabama's Hugo Lafayette Black, old-style politician Tom Heflin, 2 months ago, returns to do battle against New Deal new-style politician Lister Hill. First week of the campaign.
Take the stand of my opponent, Tom Heflin, on the wages and hours bill. Let him explain that if he can. Let Tom Heflin stand up like a man.
My fellow countrymen, I well recall that day in 1912 when Samuel Gompers came to me and said, "Tom, what is a wage? What is an hour?" And I turned to my friend, the great Samuel Gompers, and replied, "Sam, you and I are going."
Fourth week of the campaign.
Heflin loves the farmer. But what is he going to do for the farmer? He loves the businessman, too. He loves babies, and he loves
folks, mothers. In Washington, they used to call me every man's friend. It was my weakness. I well remember that day in 1914 when I introduced a bill that made Mother's Day a national institution. There was not a dry eye in the house. Why, there was a time when...
Sixth week of the campaign.
How does Heflin stand on the TVA? How does he stand on the tariff? What is he going to do for...
Folks, a vote for Heflin is a vote against the boll weevil, against the plague of malaria and chills and fever in this fair state. A vote for Heflin is a vote...
Election day.
For Tom Heflin, 48,200 votes. For Lister Hill, some 88,000 votes.
Down to political limbo this week goes the last of the old-style Southern spellbinders. before economic issues unknown to the heyday of Tom Heflin. And this week in a hospital recuperating from an illness, told of the election results, says old orator Heflin,
"It matters not. It matters not. The Lord will take care of his children."
1938 marches on. Spain. It is the 10th day of the Siege of Teruel. For 10 days, bombarded from air and from the land, beaten back from one refuge to another, 2,000 rebel troops and civilians have finally garrisoned themselves in the caverns under the besieged convent of Santa Clara. For 2 days, there has been no food. Water is rationed out a teaspoonful at a time. Occasionally, a child whimpers. Occasionally, a man speaks. An officer turns to his subordinate.
It has been a long time. Perhaps something will be arranged at last.
Not by him. He'll make no bargains with the Reds. He'd rather see us all...
Who goes there?
Commanding officer, Colonel Darko.
For any terms, reach, Colonel?
No. We will accept only unconditional surrender.
Then we will remain here until...
Until we are relieved by our own forces or by that other alternative which we have sworn to face as officers of the Spanish army.
What's that got to do with it?
Sergeant.
Trapped here without food or water, light, dying here in the darkness, 2,000 of us.
Sergeant, you will report yourself in custody at once.
No, I'm not going to starve. I'm going to fight my way out or surrender while I'm still alive. Hey, all of you, listen to me. He's sentencing you all to death. To death, I tell you.
One of your men, Captain.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. Bury him as soon as possible.
In the caverns under Santa Clara, the refugees wait. Women with their children, the living with the dead. Their speech now is dry with a long thirst. They speak of water and food. They speak of the cold and of the dead, or not at all. Day follows day in the long vigil in the caverns under Santa Clara.
Police one. Blood poisoning. We have no antiseptics, no dressings. Let us go on.
Colonel, please. Some water. Please.
There is no water, senor.
It is not for me. It is for my baby. I was feeding him before, but he must have water.
I am sorry, senor.
Then he will die like my husband. Why? For what?
There is still hope, senor. And if relief does not come, is not an honorable death.
An honorable death? What does a starving baby know of honor?
Senora.
What small sacrifices must we make for honor? 2,000 lives is not too much.
Senora.
But you won't have to kill my baby. If he must die, I can kill him. I can beat his brains out against the wall.
No, no. Stop her.
I have done it. Take him.
One of you men, take her away.
Yes, doctor.
Shall we go on, Colonel?
No. We must surrender. Tell them... I will surrender.
This week in Concord Teruel, for 2,000 emaciated men and women comes release from the nightmare of 18 days in the caverns beneath the convent of Santa Clara. For loyalist Spain comes its first major offensive victory and its greatest victory of any kind since the Civil War began. For rebel Colonel Francisco Darcourt, because he surrendered, denunciation as a traitor by his own rebel forces, the prospect of a trial for treason by the forces of the Madrid government. Time marches on. Hamilton, Bermuda. In the office of the Royal Gazette and Colonist one day this week, newspaper counter clerk Evelyn Stovall and a friend stare admiringly at two photographs on the wall.
Oh, Evelyn, how beautiful.
The Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
I packed up those pictures myself. See what I wrote underneath?
They're happy now. Oh, the Duke and Duchess are handsome, aren't they?
Good morning, miss.
Oh, good morning, sir.
I've come to pay my subscription to the Royal Gazette and Colonist. Brown is the name. Bishop Arthur Heber Brown.
That will be 2 guineas, Your Grace.
Well,
what's the matter? Are you ill?
They're happy now. Pictures of that pair in a public place. Why?
Wait! Your Grace!
You may cancel my subscription, young woman. And I shall see that those pictures are properly disposed of. Good day.
Well, of all the... For heaven's sake.
Well, there's nothing you can do, Evelyn. He is the Bishop of Bermuda.
Well, you stay here and mind this office. I'll take care of the Bishop of Bermuda.
But already several blocks away, pedaling the traditional Bermuda bicycle, is Bermuda's Bishop Brown, a breathless young curate riding along beside him.
But what did she say, Your Grace?
Never mind what she said. Just pedal.
Hey, Bishop! Wait! Stop! Bishop!
I knew it.
It's a young woman on the bicycle.
Of course it is. Pretend you don't hear. And pedal.
Past the post office and City Hall, doubling back along Hamilton's busy front street.
Is she gaining on us, William?
Don't think you're going to get away. Don't forget, we're on an island.
Oh, my word, Your Grace. People are staring.
Stop it!
Pedal, William, pedal.
Your Grace, I'm giving up. I've never been a strong man. Godspeed.
Past the Bermudiana, back along the road from Spanish Point and up the driveway to the Bishop's residence, where two bicycles finally draw to a halt.
Really, young woman,
Your Grace, I want those pictures of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
Young woman,
it's no good you're telling me that you haven't got them, because I see them sticking right out of your pocket.
Very well. Here you are. And if I were you, I'd...
For me, you wouldn't have to worry what my newspaper will say tomorrow, when I tell them what you did.
Promptly next day in the Royal Gazette and Colonist, employer of brash Evelyn Stovall, appears a letter to the editor.
The bishop deeply regrets that, yielding to a sudden impulse, he so far forgot himself as to take such arbitrary action, and has returned the disputed pictures to their rightful owner. The bishop can only say that he blames himself as severely as any other person can blame him.
1938, marches on. Trenton, New Jersey. The executive offices of Governor Harold Giles Hoffman.
Come in, please. Come right in. How do you do, Mr. Harkless? Mr. Allen?
How do you do, Governor?
Gentlemen, I'm presenting today the reward offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the murderer of the Lindbergh baby. But first, I want to state once more my belief that the Lindbergh case was not solved completely with the conviction of Hoffman. I think that more than one person is involved in this case. And I am...
Such is the preface to a scene typical of the long drama which this week plays to its final curtain. As one by one, the strange assortment of characters step forward to receive rewards of money. Characters recalled for perhaps the last time from the welter of weird and vivid scenes, the procession of doubts and confusions, witnesses and events in the crime of the century.
First award.
Office. I saw something awful in those woods. I found something.
What? Well, what'd you find?
I didn't dare look at it close, but it's lying under the leaves with the foot sticking out. I think there's a dead baby in those woods.
To colored handyman William Allen for finding in the Sauerland Mountains the body of Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Jr., $5,000.
Second award.
That's 5 gallons of ethyl, 98 cents, please.
Here you are.
$10. Oh, a gold note, huh? Don't see many of these since we went off gold.
No, I guess you don't. But I still got a few left. About 100.
It's 98. 1, 4 is 5, 5 or 10. Thank you. Goodbye, mister.
Goodbye.
What are you doing here? Writing down his number.
New York, 4U1341. Something screwy about that guy having 100 gold notes.
To Billing Station Manager Walter Lyle for the gold note clue which led federal agents to the Bronx garage of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, $7,500.
Third award.
Okay, mister?
I want you to take this letter for me.
What's the matter with the post office?
The letter has to get there tonight. Here's a dollar for you.
Oh, thanks. I better be sure I can read its address.
It goes to Dr. John F. Condon, 2974 Decatur Avenue.
To cab driver Joseph Anthony Peroni, for identifying as Bruno Richard Hauptmann, the man who gave him one of the first ransom letters to Japsy Condon, a reward of $1,000.
Fourth award.
Now, Mr. Hackman, where were you on the afternoon of the kidnapping?
I was at my home near the Lindberghs. I saw a car coming around the corner, pretty good speed. The man in there glared out at me as if he saw a ghost. That man is in this courtroom, right over there.
To Sauerland's Ulster, Amanda's Hockmuth, for placing Bruno Richard Hauptmann near the scene of the crime, $1,000. And this week to six other state's witnesses for odds and ends of evidence, rewards ranging from $500 to $2,000 each. To 100 vigilant bank clerks for turning in ransom currency, $30 each. But this week, as the curtain rings down on the still unexplained suicide of nursemaid Violet Sharp, on the fabrications of John Hughes Curtis, on the eccentricities of Japsy Condon, and the kidnapping and torture of Paul Wendell, heard from is one witness who still speaks for the defense, the widow, Bruno D. Richard Hauptmann.
They convicted Bruno. They sent him to die. They got paid for it in blood money. Blood money.
Time marches on.
The empire of the English is decadent. The British fleet is a museum piece. Arabs, place your hopes in Benito Mussolini, the friend and protector of Islam. Fascist Italy is the surest support.
Such is the daily radio fare broadcast over a two-year period from Il Duce's shortwave station at Bari, aimed at Britain's Arabian subjects. Then, fortnight ago, in London's House of Commons...
Gentlemen, I ask what His Majesty's government proposes to do about Mussolini's poisonous propaganda.
The Italian government has received more than one protest in the matter.
What good are protests when Mussolini is deliberately fomenting Arabian revolt by wireless throughout the British Empire?
Gentlemen, within 2 weeks, our own British Broadcasting Company will begin daily programs to the entire Arabian world. We have studied our audience, gentlemen, and without stooping to propaganda, we are designing programs and entertainment certain to appeal to all Islam, including, I might add, some of the empire's best talent. If necessary, His Majesty's government will see that there is a British wireless in every Arab tent.
Then, one evening this week in a Jerusalem suburban cafe, a group of Arabs clusters about a shining new British radio.
It is the appointed hour, Hassan. Which shall it be? The Italian
or... The English claim great things. Set the pointer at the London number.
Opening our first broadcast to Arabia, the British Broadcasting Company takes pleasure in presenting a musical selection in the new American manner of swing. Carol Gibbons and his Savoy Boyfriends.
What kind of music is this? Screeches, howls.
By the prophet, what man can understand the ways of the English?
Try the Italian numeral.
We give you the most beloved voice in all Arabia. the silver-tongued nightingale of Levant, Abdul Wahab. Abdul. In one moment.
Abdul Wahab. There is a voice.
The Italians know what is good. Listen.
So begins the great Anglo-Italian radio war of 1938 for the favor of the Muslim world. Up and down the Holy Land, 20-odd thousand radios tune out Great Britain, tune in Italy. As from one end of the Arabian Peninsula to the other, from Yemen to the Persian Gulf and beyond, throughout the Muslim world this week... Against the lone Arabian voice this week, Britain's radio offensive flounders. And on the eve of the U.S. premiere of the Arabian singer's all-Arabian cinema, Tears of Love, British officials look high and low for a radio champion better than Italy's Abdul Wahab, known as the Bing Crosby of the Near East. Time marches on. Washington, D.C.
Mr. Knudsen, isn't it a fact that 1937 was the best year in General Motors history?
That is true, Senator.
Mr. Knudsen, isn't it also a fact that you raised prices just...
Thus, this week, before a special Senate committee to investigate U.S. unemployment and relief, convened on the heels of a new federal estimate of 16 million U.S. unemployed, General Motors President William Knudsen is questioned by North Carolina Senator Jim Burns.
Mr. Knudsen, you have admitted that 1937 was a prosperous year for General Motors. Yet you found it necessary to curtail production and lay off 30,000 men. Why was that?
Well, there was a marked slackening in our sales about December 1st.
Can you explain that to the committee, Mr. Knudsen?
Well, Senator, when a man is none too certain of the future, he just gets along with his old car, even if he needs a new one. It's a matter of confidence.
Do you think mass layoffs promote confidence?
No, I don't. But if we keep the men on, what would we have them do?
Well, if you were to reemploy those 30,000 men and thus help restore confidence, it follows that there'd soon be something for them to do, doesn't it?
I have to admit your argument is fair, Senator, but General Motors alone can't solve a nationwide problem.
What do you think the government might do to help restore confidence, Mr. Knudsen?
I don't know what the government can do, Senator. I don't know.
And on the floor of the United States Senate...
Oh, Mr. President, has the South foreseen this anti-lynching bill when we surrender
the... Government and business this week ponder the problem of unemployment. But in the Senate, reviving the notorious anti-lynching filibuster, hour after hour this week, day after day...
The flower of Southern womanhood, insulted and despoiled, even her jewelry taken from her in the hideous manner I have just described. Then think of this.
This week, as senators in committee probe for a solution to the nation's most pressing problem, as senators on the floor aimlessly orate, as Franklin Roosevelt calls a conference of the nation's bigwig industrialists, a waiting nation hears of yet another approach to the cure of economic ills. As news hawks seek out the dean of U.S. industrialists, 74-year-old Henry Ford, who guides them through his huge Dearborn plant.
Now, you see, young fellow, we're still making cars at Ford's. Say, look at that big machine over there.
What is it?
That machine stamps out a whole automobile body in one operation, and it's a stronger body than ever.
Well, how much of this unemployment do you think is due to labor-saving machinery, Mr. Ford?
There shouldn't be any. Now, just looky here. Take a look at this. What would you say it is?
Why, it's a curved piece of sheet metal. Steel, I'd guess.
Yes, of course you would. Now, look. I put it down this concrete floor, curved side up. Oh, now watch. Jump on it. Kicker. Doc, what do you think of that? Pretty strong, eh? Now, I'll just examine it, young man.
Huh. It's not even nicked.
Oh, of course not. It's been steel. It's been bent under that treatment.
What is it?
Soybeans. Just plain garden variety soybeans. Cheapest thing in the world, and better than steel. Someday, whole automobiles will be made out of soybeans. And when that happens, we're going to have prosperity like you never saw.
How do you figure that, Mr. Ford?
I, the farmer, sell soybeans to business. Business sells tractors and cars back to the farmer. Hang profits, high wages, low prices. I, with the farm and industry working together, there's a market in this country that's absolutely unlimited.
At week's end, sharply reversing the trend of more than 6 months, startling new reports burgeon along the nation's economic fronts. U.S. Steel rehires 70,000 workers. Sears Roebuck and Company reduces prices 12%, promises no more layoffs. DuPont announces new capital investment of $35 million for the coming year. The automobile industry rehires 100,000 men. But as Franklin Roosevelt prepares to push his billion-dollar rearmament program through Congress, as following a presidential message, the Ludlow anti-war referendum goes down to defeat, raised as the voice of an oldster who for 25 years has been number one historian of the changing U.S. scene, Charles A. Beard.
In the world today, belligerent foreign policies, rearmament, and war are being used as recovery measures by more than one nation. Economic and political trends in the United States during the past 6 months seem to indicate that the American people will soon be forced to choose whether they want the easy way of rearmament or the hard way of patience and thoughtful reforms in our economic system.
Time marches on. The pageant of the week's news. The story is dramatic, tragic, exciting, stranger than fiction. You have followed tonight on the march of time. It is this great news pageant of the world that the magazine Life is unfolding every week before the eyes of its readers, in pictures. Men and women like Life. Youngsters like Life. All kinds of people with all sorts of interests like this new magazine of pictures. Doctors likewise like its picture presentation of the news of the week. Endorse its unique treatment of medical subjects. Says editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, Dr. Morris Fishbein.
Life's photographic essay on cancer was a feature unlike anything that ever appeared before in a general magazine. I believe it to be a medical milestone in public education.
There's Dr. George J. Nelbach, Executive Secretary, State Committee on Tuberculosis and Public Health, New York City.
Life has achieved a fine balance in compressing within 8 pages the history, the drama, the hopes, the failures, the progress, and the modern weapons of the fight against tuberculosis. I applaud Life for its willingness to give its readers this intelligent glimpse into a problem which comes close to every individual and home in the nation. More power to you.
Says Herbert N. Bunderson, president of the Chicago Board of Health.
The pneumonia control story in Life has been the greatest single factor toward giving added impetus to our drive on pneumonia here in Chicago. Mayor Kelly has asked me to do everything in my power to organize the city's pneumonia fighting facilities in the manner Life has suggested. You're doing a fine job. Life is like sterling silver. You have many imitators, but people who know can see that you are the real thing.
For the cooperation and advice which make Life's photographic essays on medicine informative as well as accurate, Life gives grateful acknowledgement to the medical profession. In every story it prints, its photographic essays, its picture presentation of science, art, industry, the cinema, in its pictorial record of the news of each week, Life's aim is the same. Through pictures to inform. The new issue of Life is on sale tomorrow. News dealers have another 100,000 additional copies, but many newsstands will be sold out by tomorrow night. So to make sure of getting your copy, we suggest you ask your news dealer for Life tomorrow, Friday morning. Time marches on. Again next Thursday night at this same time, the March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company.